Hi, it's Curious City editor Susie Ahn. March is Women's History Month, and we're revisiting a couple of stories about some trailblazing women. Some remembered, many overlooked. Where are all the tributes to women in Chicago? Like the bronze and stone monuments of them.
Kids need to be able to look around, boys and girls, look around and say, I can be that.
The city has an appalling underrepresentation of statues recognizing historic female figures. But there are people trying to change that. But first up, we'll take a step back, 125 years back, to the beginning of a system here in the U.S. that recognized the need to separate kids from adults in our prison population. It may seem unthinkable now, but the U.S. legal system treated children the same as adults until the late 19th century, when a group of Cook County women demanded change and reconfigured the juvenile criminal justice system forever. That's next, after the break. Several years back, reporter Quinn Myers took a look at one of Chicago's most influential exports, the juvenile justice system. Here's Quinn.
If you're under 18 and get arrested in Cook County, you'll usually go through a separate legal system designed for young people. But until the beginning of the 20th century, many children who ran into trouble with the law were tried and jailed alongside adults. That is, until the world's first juvenile court was established in 1899, right here in Chicago. It's the origins of that court that Andrea Krieg, a criminal justice professor at Elmhurst College, wants to know more about.
So with every juvenile delinquency textbook, I would say, there is one sentence that says the first juvenile court was created in Cook County, Illinois, and then it just keeps moving on. And for most people across the U.S., they probably don't think anything of it. But us being in Chicago and Chicagoland, I started to wonder kind of, wait, I want more information.
More information like where exactly was the first juvenile court? How did it function? Who was eligible? And why did it start here in Chicago? The answers to Andrea's questions are rooted in the Progressive Era, when a group of impassioned activists in Chicago, most of them women, developed the model for the first juvenile court. But as it spread and evolved over the 20th century, the court started to move away from how it was originally conceived. It ended up looking more and more like the adult criminal system it had hoped to replace. Today, those shifts have presented a wide range of challenges for the juvenile justice system. But they've also inspired new efforts to reevaluate how we detain and rehabilitate children and young adults. Efforts that, in some ways, harken back to what the reformers had in mind over a century ago. Let's start back in 1882. By one count, there were at least 20 kids under the age of 11 in the Cook County Jail.
So there's concerns about putting young people in the same cells or institutions with adults, you know, leads to violent sexual abuse. The fear is that the criminal justice system, if you put kids into it, just is going to educate them to become vicious, hardened criminals.
That's University of Nevada professor David Tannenhaus, the author of Juvenile Justice in the Making. One story Tannenhaus dug up involves a 10-year-old boy who stole a pair of shoes and then spent almost 2 weeks in the county jail before appearing before a grand jury. It was situations like this that attracted the attention of a group of women social reformers in the late 1880s. Many of them were among the first generation of American women to go to college, and they congregated at Jane Addams Hull House. They were especially concerned with the plight of children in a rapidly industrializing Chicago. Two reformers in particular spearheaded the movement for a separate court for children. Lucy Flower was a wealthy philanthropist who served on the Chicago School Board and helped create what became the Cook County School of Nursing. She knew how to work the institutions. Flower had the idea to create a so-called parental court. She had two goals: to keep kids out of the harsh conditions of adult prison and to prevent them from becoming lifelong criminals. The other leader in this movement was Flower's friend, Julia Lathrop. She was a Hull House social worker and knew how prisons operated. Lathrop toured every jail in Illinois, documenting the conditions there. Together, they started pushing for an official juvenile legal system.
So it's the kind of combination of these women who, you know, are very politically astute. They'll work with leaders of all the different religious organizations in the city. They'll work with men in the Bar Association.
And then in 1899, the Illinois legislature passed a bill creating the world's first juvenile justice system. It was modeled after Flowers' parental court.
And then Chicago becomes a model through creating this kind of remarkable legislation, the talent of the people involved.
The first juvenile cases were heard at the county building in downtown Chicago. 8 years later, an official court was built across from Hull House on what is now UIC's campus. Professor Thomas Garrity teaches juvenile law at Northwestern. He says unlike the adult system, the procedures of the first juvenile court were designed to be purposefully informal.
The judge might be sitting around a table as opposed to in a formal courtroom. The children and families would be sitting at a table, again, as opposed to standing in the dock as a criminal defendant would. And the objective of the judge was to try to act in the best interests of the child and not to impose harsh consequences upon the child.
The reformers hoped this approach would allow judges and probation officers to provide individual solutions to each child's case.
They did not have attorneys, and actually the idea was that probation officers would stand up and let the judge know what they thought was in the best interest of the child.
The model of the Chicago court spread rapidly. By 1925, every state except Maine and Wyoming had some kind of juvenile court system. The early reformers hoped that the new approach would help kids stay out of the legal system. But instead, as the court grew, Tannenhaus says they noticed the same kids kept coming back. It was a revolving door.
It doesn't solve the problem of, you know, children growing up without the support that they need from families and communities. It's not going to solve those structural problems.
And Garrity says there is another problem that arose as the system scaled up.
A problem that, of course, developed was that children were being dealt with in a rather summary fashion.
One important example involved a 15-year-old boy who made an obscene phone call. He was arrested, but no one told his parents. He was convicted and sentenced without a lawyer.
Without representation of counsel and without due process. So we have in the 60s a series of Supreme Court decisions, which we call the due process, you know, revolution.
Those decisions began to formalize a process the early progressive reformers had wanted to keep flexible and intimate.
And from then on, children were entitled to counsel. They were entitled to confront witnesses. They could not be deprived of their liberty without proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
As the due process revolution expanded legal protections for juveniles, the court began to look and operate a lot more like the adult system. And starting in the late 1970s, Garrity says, the ideals of the early reformers lost even more ground after a series of high-profile cases made many fear that kids were getting off too easy. States started transferring more juveniles directly to adult courts and prisons. These transfers reflected what Tannenhaus calls a moral panic in the national discourse on crime in the 1980s and 90s. In Cook County's juvenile detention center, this was matched by rampant overcrowding and abusive conditions. In the late 90s and early 2000s, activists and institutions started reassessing that tough-on-crime approach, kicking off yet another era of reform for the juvenile court. Betsy Clark has been at the forefront of those modern-day reforms. She's the founder of the Juvenile Justice Initiative, a nonprofit based in Evanston. Clark says there's been progress made over the past 20 years, like a steep reduction in the number of incarcerated kids. But she says the court still faces a number of obstacles. For one, children of color and from low-income families are overrepresented in the system.
We do things in this country that no other developed country does. We prosecute children as adults. We give them lengthy sentences in the adult court. We lock up children, even though we've reduced a lot, we lock them up at still much higher rates than other developed nations. So it's a funny dichotomy. We were the leader over a century ago, and now we just need to change some of these policies to catch up.
Today, years after the first juvenile court was established, Clark's concerns echo those of the early reformers. She'd like to move away from trying any juvenile in adult courts. She also wants to provide more education and professional resources for at-risk communities. But she'd also like to change the definition of juvenile itself to include people in their early 20s. She says research shows the brain's decision-making abilities aren't fully formed until a person reaches their mid-20s. That research is driving a program launched by Cook County in August 2017 called the Restorative Justice Community Court, and it has some ideas similar to what those early reformers had in mind. The court is open to nonviolent offenders between the ages of 18 and 26, just over the age of eligibility for the juvenile system, from Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood. All in all, just a small number of people. It brings together an offender, victim, and members of the community. They sit together in a peace circle, where they discuss the motivations behind the crime, the harm caused by it, and potential solutions.
The focus is on repairing harm from crime, as opposed to being strictly punitive. And in restorative justice, the best way in which to do that is to have the people who are most directly affected by that crime be at the table or be at the circle, so to speak.
That's Judge Colleen Sheehan, who oversees the court. The goal is to create what are called repair of harm agreements. They might include something like community service or connecting an offender with job training or a mentor in the field they're interested in. Like the reformers behind the first juvenile court, Sheehan hopes the peace circles find specific solutions for every case.
The through line is both of these courts being innovative, and innovative not just to do something new, but innovative in order to address a particular issues or problems that I think that society was facing.
As for our question asker, Andrea, she says she isn't surprised to learn that what the juvenile court was intended to be isn't quite what we have now.
Which I think is kind of the criminal justice system at its foundation, right? That we always have different intentions and then there's collateral consequences.
This story originally ran in 2019. Quinn Myers is a reporter with Block Club Chicago. Thomas Garrity is currently Professor Emeritus of Law at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Judge Colleen Sheehan retired in 2019, but the Restorative Justice Community Court is still in place. There are locations in North Lawndale, Avondale, and Englewood. Up next, ever notice how many statues there are around the city and how so few of them are of women? After the break, we look at why these historic figures are so figuratively and literally absent.
Hi, I'm reporter Liz Stanton. I'm in Ping Tom Memorial Park in Chinatown with question asker Kate Hannigan. We're standing in front of a bronze statue of a woman, Justice Laura Liu. She was the first Chinese-American to serve on the Illinois Appellate Court. Liu looks out heroically towards the city, book in hand, chest back, head up.
It just kind of says she was here. She contributed. The people in her community felt like it was worthwhile to put this up and show that she is a part of the living, breathing, beating heart of Chicago.
That's Kate, and she wants to know why there aren't more statues like this one around Chicago. She knows that great women were here, they contributed, and she thinks they deserve to be recognized.
Kids need to be able to look around, boys and girls, look around and say, I can be that. I remember wanting to be Johnny Carson when I was a kid because I couldn't think of, like, any amazing women, honestly, which sounds a little ridiculous.
Chicago has close to 40 full-size statues of men, sometimes called figurative sculptures. And just one full-size statue representing a real historical woman, the judge we're standing in front of. So Kate's right, and she's on a mission of sorts. She'd like to see more statues of women around the city. To her, the lack of figurative statues, of women you can recognize, it's a reflection of the way women's contributions have been overlooked, and Kate thinks this should change. She thinks the statues that you see, they have an impact on people, and they reflect the values of our society. She's even got a list of women she thinks should be honored. Jane Addams, Bessie Coleman, and Gwendolyn Brooks, to name a few. But to understand why there is such disparity in statues, Kate and I head to the Chicago Women's Park and Gardens. It's located at 18th Street and Indiana Avenue. There we meet with historian Julia Bachrach.
It's so pretty noisy over here, so hopefully that'll...
Bachrach says there's a reason we don't see more full-size figurative statues of women in Chicago. It's because this style of statue was mainly popular during the late 19th and early 20th century. And at that time,
nobody was thinking about honoring women, and if they were, they didn't have enough clout to do a figurative monument.
She says that by the time the city, historical societies, and private donors started to memorialize women in the 1990s, figurative statues had gone out of style. The park we're in has an example of the type of sculpture that was being made at this time.
We are standing right in front of a monument that's called Helping Hands, and it is the monument to Jane Addams. This sculpture was the first major monument to a historical woman in Chicago.
It was created by the artist Louise Bourgeois and first installed in 1996. Let that sink in. The first major monument honoring a historical woman was installed in 1996. The sculpture consists of hands carved from black granite that sit atop a circle of stone pedestals.
This is not idealizing, but, you know, representing kind of her mission, but it's not her. I think it's still okay, you know, because you look at this and you learn about Jane Addams, and I think that that's good.
But she'd still prefer a statue. Chicago does have a handful of other sculptures honoring women, including memorial benches or statues of goddesses or fictional characters. But this isn't what Kate craves when she walks through our streets. She wants to see the real women, and she's not alone. In 2017, artist Carrie James Marshall unveiled an outdoor mural depicting the faces of influential women in the arts at the Chicago Cultural Center. And at the University of Chicago, two students noticed there weren't many images of women on campus. They launched a campaign to commission and install a bust of the first black woman to receive a PhD from the university, Dr. Georgiana Rose Simpson. It took nearly 3 years of work and close to $50,000 to make it happen. Kate and I check out the unveiling.
Let's go take a closer look. Oh, we can't look at how many people we can barely even get in.
Mandel Hall, where the bronze bust is located, is buzzing with people trying to get a glimpse.
That's exciting. I think people are very happy about this.
The bust represents not only the physical likeness of an important woman, but it also signals change in a place where images of mostly white men have filled the walls and halls. To Kate, this is an example of what needs to happen all over the city. And in fact, there is a movement for change like this happening across the country. Advocates are fighting for everything from erecting statues of women in New York Central Park to getting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. They say giving women credit for their accomplishments in public places is needed in all corners of our country, now more than ever. Naomi Beckwith is a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, and she says this movement, it's got people thinking about what visual representation means to our society.
Our attention now is toward the visual in a really, really deep way. And I think so many people thought that that would make us passive. But I think what's happening now in a really beautiful way is that so many folks are saying, no, images mean something. And perhaps I have a little bit of agency in thinking about what our visual life is and should be as a nation.
And Beckwith says some people think the problem isn't simply that we lack statues of women, but that the historic statues and monuments themselves are the issue. She suggests that perhaps the concept of how we honor someone needs to shift and pushes Kate to imagine something more abstract, like the work of artist Doho Su. He created an empty pedestal, or plinth.
And it was up to you to imagine who could be on that plinth. I'd love to see something like that in Chicago, maybe a plinth that just says, imagine a powerful woman here.
And Beckwith thinks it's worth thinking about what these different ways of representing women mean.
There, I think, is a very kind of fruitful debate to be had about, is a figurative representation of a woman still the best way, or even the most feminist way, an egalitarian way to represent heroic figures?
This is great food for thought. This is really thought-provoking.
Our visit to the MCA has prompted Kate to think beyond just the typical statue and the story it tells. But Kate isn't sure it solves her problem. She takes a lot of walks around the city with her three kids, and she sees a lot of statues of men. She'd still like her kids to see more women.
And I just still can't stop thinking about what if we had these images, this representation throughout the city. We have currently dogs on Michigan Avenue. We have had cows. I think we had Marilyn Monroe, and you could look up her skirt. Like, all of those things are ways people remember our city. Why not remember it through these amazing Chicagoans?
This story originally ran in 2018 and was reported by Liz Stanton. Naomi Beckwith is now with the Guggenheim in New York City. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is part of the NPR network. The show is produced by Jason Mark and Joe Dassault. Maggie Civet is the digital and engagement producer, and I edit the show. I'm Susie Ahn. Thanks for listening.